Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Joan Robin on behalf of Mr. Edward Wilson. Given today's time constraints...
You're representing whom?
Mr. Edward Wilson.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Given the time constraints, I've selected one issue to focus my portion of the oral argument upon, and with respect to the remaining issues that I'm not able to address today, I would simply rely on my brief as to those arguments. But the central point that I want to focus on today involves the jury instructions and the jury instruction procedure employed by the district court. Specifically, Mr. Wilson contends that the district court improperly instructed the jury with respect to the need to make an individualized determination of drug quantity culpability for purposes of 841B. As I see it, this issue has two parts. Two questions. The first is whether or not the instructions actually given by the court properly instructed the jury as to the law, and the second being whether or not the court erred in refusing to instruct the jury on the two particular instructions that were requested by defense counsel. With respect to the first, it's a de novo standard of review, and on the second question, it's an abuse of discretion review.
Your basic point was that you didn't think that the two defendants here were sufficiently individuated.
That's correct.
And but when the district court actually gave the jury two separate verdict forms.
Correct.
Did it not? And there was one separate verdict form for each of the defendants.
Correct.
And then the court explains to the jury that they would it would have to determine separately whether each defendant in and of itself was guilty. And wouldn't those separate verdict forms, together with the court's admonition to the jury about determining guilt on an individual basis, wouldn't that sufficiently allay your concern that the two defendants were lumped together? Because you don't always have those separate verdict forms, and here the district court was very careful to keep it separate.
And had the district court ever actually said you need to consider these individuals separately? And given one of the requested instructions that I specifically asked for, I agree we would be in a different position.
What else could a separate verdict form mean?
Well, not the way that it was explained, and I think I addressed in my brief that the judge actually at one point instructs the jury that they are to proceed with their deliberations and that for the purpose of reaching a unanimous verdict. It does say that your verdict must be unanimous as to each of the defendants, but when explaining the verdict form, it says now you'll have an opportunity to check either guilty or not guilty for Mr. Collins, and then if you find guilty, there's a place for drug weight. And then the same for Mr. Wilson is exactly what the court says, the same for Mr. Wilson. So he doesn't, and I believe I cited to the joint appendix in that portion of my reply brief, but he certainly doesn't say you need to make a separate determination with respect to Mr. Wilson when it comes to individual determination of drug quantity and what is individually foreseeable to Mr. Wilson, not necessarily foreseeable to both Mr. Wilson and Collins together.
Over and over again, you have to decide this case based on the evidence presented in this courtroom.
In this courtroom, right, but there was evidence obviously against both, and the evidence against Mr. Collins was just voluminous in comparison to the evidence against Mr. Wilson. And just to reiterate, there was testimony that Mr. Collins was involved with an extensive drug dealing with Mr. Buckner, dealing up to 2 kilograms every 2 days, none of which implicated Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson wasn't present for any of it.
The district court's instruction said you're instructed that defendants are accountable for the quantity of controlled substances that they personally distributed. Or that they could reasonably foresee that others would distribute during and in furtherance of the conspiracy. Now, you know, that's a very commonplace conspiracy notion, which is reasonable foreseeability. And it says you can't attribute these drugs to the defendant unless, number one, they personally distributed it themselves, or they could reasonably foresee that others would distribute it. And that serves, I don't understand why that's wouldn't serve to locate culpability on an individual basis, that instruction?
Because it says they. So what is reasonable foreseeable to the two of them? In other, what they reasonably foresee, and including Mr. Collins and Mr. Wilson in one lump together. Collins specifically requires an individual determination of reasonable foreseeability. It also lumps them together in the earlier part of what they personally distribute. And they being the subject, the two of them, not simply Mr. Wilson, but the two of them together.
What about the word personally?
Personally simply means in person. It's an adverb. It modifies the verb. It doesn't modify the subject. It doesn't change who is doing the action. The people that are doing the action
somebody
is
personally,
they, the
if two somebody, defendants. If somebody personally does something, would it mean that somebody else did not?
No, it means that they can apply to either, the personally can apply to either a single person or a group of persons. In this indication, in this example, the court is replying when saying they personally, it simply means that these two personally. In other words, these two in person. That's the correct grammatical sense of it. And certainly the court is required to issue clear instructions. Our instructions were clear, the ones that the district court said that he would give, entitled minimum quantity of narcotics. That's not what he gave. He gave something entirely different. It was a non-model instruction by the government, which misstated the law. I see that I'm into my rebuttal.
Ms. Robin, I know you weren't going into sufficiency of the evidence, but could you answer one question for me, and that is, does the record show who owned the blue Acura?
No, it does not. It's very clear that Mr. Buckner does not know who owned the blue Acura.
Okay.
Thank you.
Leiby.
Thank you. May it please the court. Chris Leibig on behalf of Mr. Collins. I'll first focus on our issue for Mr. Collins' motion to suppress. Agent Bryant asked Houston Police Officer Lee if Mr. Collins consented to a search of his vehicle, of the vehicle he was driving. Officer Lee stated yes. That's the entirety of the evidence on voluntary consent upon which the court based its finding. Some notable facts in the record are the fact that, one, Officer Lee isn't someone that was known to anyone else who testified in the case. His age was not known to anyone else that testified in the case. Someone surmised that he looked about 30. How long he had been on the force was not known, and beyond surmise that he had likely attended a police academy since he was a police officer that they had just met minutes before, there was no evidence about what it would even mean to him to use the term consent. And I think a series of questions that was put forward at JA 145 pretty much says it all for this case. Agent Bryant states that Lee probably went to the police academy. Then he was asked, other than that, you have no idea what the term consent means to him. That's correct. I have no idea.
Did Collins present any evidence at the suppression hearing?
No.
That's odd, isn't it, if you feel like you did not consent? Of course, you don't have to. Certainly Collins doesn't have to come forward, but wouldn't it have been helpful to have presented some evidence to the effect that you didn't?
I certainly can't deny that it wouldn't have been helpful, but Judge, I would submit to you respectfully that it would be on this record that it would be unfair to for any defendant to even have to consider subjecting himself to cross-examination on any point, because it was so obvious at that point that based upon this record, that based, again, solely on that, based upon that conversation alone, you searched the car, yes. With that record, it's utter silence on voluntariness, absolute silence.
Does it make any difference that the defendant was sitting there kind of casually while this was going on, making no objection?
It actually does not make a difference, and here's why. I understand that that's one of the 2 points the government makes in its brief. He was, quote, appearing confident and was wearing a, quote, smirk on his face.
Well, I don't know about smirks. I'm not into that.
Right, okay.
The fact that he
looked calm.
Actively.
The evidence is that none of these people had ever been up close to Mr. Collins, didn't know how he normally holds his face, doesn't know what he's thinking, doesn't even know if it's his vehicle. The government also makes the point that somehow that because he didn't just walk away, that must mean he consented. Well, he didn't just walk away because there were four FBI vehicles and a police cruiser right around him that had just obviously done a serious traffic stop. He probably thought he was under arrest. But, I mean, the point is that the fact that he has is holding a particular look on his face cannot possibly meet the government's burden in this situation. I think what this really is a very narrowly presented, unlikely to present itself again issue of taking 104A simply too far. The government flew four people from Houston to testify in this matter. There's nothing on the record about why they didn't have the one person that had the actual knowledge of the only thing that truly mattered in the whole hearing.
Both of the officers were present. Both Bryant and Katrib were present. It wasn't as if there were the officers were in absentia or something. They were both present at the time of the search.
No, actually what happened was Katrib was over at the other scene. Bryant was present in his FBI unmarked car behind Officer Lee, watching it from a distance, but he absolutely did not hear Mr. Collins say one word, wasn't within listening distance whatsoever, and then he began the search with other officers. Eventually, Katrib took part.
I thought they were both at the scene.
Well, Katrib came to the scene soon enough after, but Bryant was the one who was the only person who heard Lee say yes to the question, did you consent? So I may not be exactly perfect on the moment Katrib arrived, but it hardly matters because he didn't see anything concerning the statement Lee made about consent, didn't see it, didn't hear it, didn't anything. He generally understood that had occurred, but he did not hear Lee say it. So that didn't happen. It's just Bryant. I think that the fact that I suppose there could be I would say it would be a stretch even if these agents knew this officer, were familiar with his prior work or his notion of what the term consent might mean, but utter absence of that on this record. Absolutely not one bit. This is a guy that randomly they met that night, just happened to be there, and they pulled up to him and said, will you stop this guy? Look for a traffic violation and stop this guy. Yes, that's his whole involvement. They have no idea who this guy is. It could have been his first day on the force, as far as this record shows. And, I just think that if they were going to use hearsay to establish such an important and difficult to find finding as voluntariness, they could have, if they only wanted to bring four police, they could have brought the guy that mattered, Officer Buttereb, at the beginning. He hardly added anything to the motion. And yet they called
it to the government that this was an issue at the hearing, voluntariness of the consent.
Well, Judge, we filed a pleading, and I don't have the JA site right off the top of my head on where our pleading, which is in the JA site. I filed a pleading which stated that
the voluntariness of the consent.
I don't have it memorized what we wrote, but what I said is his vehicle was searched without cause. I might have used the term consent, but without probable cause and I layered it in a certain way.
On page 54 of the joint appendix.
If you're looking at it, then I'm sure you're right. Yes,
I just want to make sure.
Yes, that looks like what pleading.
In thumbing through it, I didn't see the word consent. I didn't see the issue of consent being challenged, which makes I'm just curious as to how the government was to know that that was
a fair point. I think what's challenged is that the car was searched for no Fourth Amendment justification at all. The government coming in with their theory of justification, as you can tell from the presentation of the questions. And this motion was set a long time in advance, was coming in with a consent theory. The only theory they argued on the brief either. They knew that was the issue and didn't bring the guy. And it's just taken 104A a bit too far.
If you didn't put on any evidence, and the standard of review is on these consent searches that we overturn a finding of consent only if it's, under our Lattimore decision, implausible in light of the entire record. How's the district court's finding implausible in light of the entire record?
Two reasons,
Judge.
When
there's no evidence put on.
Thank you. Two reasons. First, Judge, it may be true that a factual finding under Lattimore is entitled to deference, but we are entitled to a de novo review of all of the facts in light most favorable to the government being true if that establishes voluntary consent. Secondly, as I put laid out in our brief and is not contested, in fact, in a moment I'll explain, was even supported by the government, the trial court stated the facts wrong by stating that two officers had heard the guy consent. The government, in their brief, and I'm not denigrating their argument, it's a hard argument for them to make, but the government stated that Collins' consent to the search was heard from other law enforcement officers with firsthand knowledge that Collins had consented. False. Absolutely false. That never happened. My guess is they're looking at what the trial court said. I would respectfully request the court to look at that fact. That simply never happened, so there shouldn't be deference given to the trial court's finding for that reason. But more importantly, we're entitled to a de novo review standard on the question of voluntariness, and there's an utter lack of anything on the record. Consent is not voluntary consent. Those two things are not the same. And I'll thank you. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Leibig. Mr. Ben-Ari.
Good morning. May it please the court. If I could speak first about the jury instruction issue raised by Appellant Wilson in this case, I would submit to the court that it's sort of in responding to the argument on jury instructions and the totality of the charge, it also is a worthwhile consideration of what the evidence was with respect to foreseeability and sort of how the Collins and Wilson drug trafficking operation worked. And the one witness that speaks most clearly to that point is Christopher Buckner. He was a cooperating witness. He's the only witness that actually had dealt with both Collins and Wilson. And if you look at Mr. Buckner's direct, he's asked to characterize Collins and Wilson's relationship specifically with respect to cocaine dealing. I'm looking at Joint Appendix page 456. And with respect to cocaine dealing, how would you characterize their relationship? And his response is, like brothers, like brothers and business partners. So when he says they're business partners, he's not talking about some other sort of business. He's talking about the cocaine distribution business, the cocaine dealing business. And so this, I would submit, is not a case where the jury is involved in a very complex portioning out of what's one defendant selling, what's reasonably foreseeable to that one defendant, what's the second defendant selling, what's reasonably foreseeable to that second.
But you agree that it's a much weaker case as to Wilson, do you not?
I don't agree with that necessarily.
Why not?
Judge Keenan. Mm-hmm. First of all, I would say that everything else about the jury's consideration is sort of got to be viewed in the context of this partnership and what.
Well, but Mr. Buckner really, you know, pretty much nailed Mr. Collins, you know, saying he was selling, 2 kilos worth of cocaine. He would go through 2 days minimum because he's a wholesaler. I mean, he was quite specific with regard to Mr. Collins.
Right.
And we don't have that with regard to Mr. Wilson.
Well,
there's evidence of a sale. There's this vague reference to being business partners, but it's not the same. So I think you need to, let's just say I'm right on that. The evidence isn't as strong as Mr. Wilson. Why is it sufficient as to Mr. Wilson?
What you have with respect to Mr. Wilson on top of this statement that they're partners and all of the normal meaning that partner conveys is you have other indicia that the jury could rely on as support for that. And one of the best pieces of government evidence on that fact is that there was evidence that Buckner arranges to purchase cocaine from Collins. He makes phone calls to Collins. He sets it up with Collins. It's agreed with Collins. On the day of the transaction, there's phone traffic back and forth shown by the phone records and evidence and testimony. Buckner calls Collins. Collins tells Buckner he can't make it. He's sending someone. There's phone calls that go back and forth between Buckner and Collins. There's phone calls that go back between Collins and Wilson. Wilson shows up to deliver the drugs. Now, here's the critical piece, in my opinion, Your Honor, is that Buckner testifies that he overpays for that cocaine. He gives Wilson too much money for the cocaine he's arranged to purchase from Collins. And that is something that business people, but particularly drug dealers. It's not a business where they have the recourse. If somebody rips them off, they can go to the police. They're very careful about these sort of things. And why does Buckner feel confident in overpaying Wilson? Because he knows that the next time he buys cocaine from Wilson's partner, Collins, he will be given a credit for that amount. And so that is another strong indicia, I would submit, of the way that they operate together. It's sort of a singular, it supports the inference that it's a single pool of drugs, a single pool of money.
With respect to Buckner's testimony, you may have already touched on this, but I thought there was evidence from Buckner's testimony that when Collins was unavailable to sell the cocaine, that Wilson would substitute for him.
Well, that is certainly what happened on this one occasion that I'm talking about. Collins was unavailable, and Wilson ends up showing up to deliver the drugs and take the money.
Was Collins supposed to be there, and for some reason he wasn't, so he sent Wilson instead, or Wilson came instead?
Correct. That's I think, a fair interpretation of what the evidence showed. Buckner, I think, testified pretty much that's exactly what happens. Collins was simply unavailable at the time that the drop-off and sale needed to occur, so he sent Buckner. Other indicia, Judge Keenan, of this partnership, and you asked the question of my colleague, Ms. Robin, about who owns the Blue Acura. Buckner's testimony was that he knew that Wilson operated a Blue Acura. And then you have the traffic stop that occurs sometime later where Collins is stopped in the Blue Acura, and you have various photos in evidence. And so the ownership, I certainly can see the title holder to that Blue Acura was not proven, but I would argue that there certainly was enough in the record that the jury could find, first, that it was the same vehicle being operated by Collins and Wilson over this time period in the drug trafficking context. And it's backed up also by the further evidence that
Wilson had an Acura SUV, am I correct?
Well, the testimony from Buckner, yes, the testimony from Buckner was that he knew Wilson to operate the car that the Blue Acura SUV, which is also the car.
Wrong, but I thought he had an SUV that he permitted Collins to drive.
So,
and that his, you made the contention on page 26 of your brief that Wilson's SUV, which he permitted Collins to drive, was outfitted with a hidden compartment designed to conceal contraband.
Correct. And so what we have, the evidence that backs up that point.
Yeah, how did that testimony come in?
So Buckner.
How did that evidence come in?
Buckner testifies that Collins operated the Blue Acura SUV, backed up by the law enforcement surveillance of the deal that we've been discussing, where Buckner makes the arrangements with Collins, but Wilson shows up. When he shows up to deliver the drugs, it's in the Blue Acura SUV. There's certain photographs in evidence. Then later on down the road, after Buckner is incarcerated, we have this traffic stop that's the subject of the suppression hearing, where Collins is stopped in the Blue Acura SUV. This search that we've heard about from my colleague Mr. Liebig occurs, and the hidden compartment is discovered. Interestingly, the evidence at trial, again, I believe mainly from Mr. Buckner, was that Collins normally operated a red pickup truck. At some point before trial, that red pickup truck was located.
Apart from Buckner's testimony, what else did you introduce? You introduced cell phone records, didn't you?
Correct. The cell phone.
And that there were a number of calls, and the cell phone records indicated Wilson was really in the loop.
Certainly with respect to the one deal where Wilson shows up to make the delivery, the pattern of calling clearly supports the notion that Buckner's calling Collins to set the deal up on the morning leading up to the deal, and then after Collins determines that he's not available, the calls that go back and forth between Collins and Wilson further corroborate the way that the drug deal occurred.
What evidence is there in the record as to when Collins first became involved in the conspiracy? Is there any evidence on that?
So,
other than the sale that he participated in?
Collins or Wilson?
Wilson, yeah, thank you.
With respect to Wilson, so it's clear that Buckner deals more frequently with Collins.
Right, but what is the evidence as to when Wilson first became involved in the conspiracy?
I think you would have to look back to Buckner's testimony, as he is the only one who personally knew Wilson out of the government's.
Okay, beyond testify. The statement that they were business partners, what other evidence points to a start date for Wilson's participation in the conspiracy?
I think that it comes from Buckner's testimony. He testifies to, in addition to the partner evidence that we've talked about, he testifies that he actually buys drugs from Wilson personally, although I'm not sure he puts a date on it. But certainly at the point that the series of controlled purchases occurs, where Wilson is actually showing up to deliver drugs, I would submit that that's clear evidence that at least at that point, Wilson has become involved in the conspiracy. Certainly there's evidence that he's dealing right with Collins in terms of the cell phone records and in terms of the fact that he shows up at Buckner's location, a location that is only made known to Collins. He delivers drugs, he takes the proceeds, and then the next time Buckner buys drugs from Collins, he's given a credit for his overpayment. So I would submit that that is evidence that at least as early as the time period of these control buys, Wilson is involved. Turning just real briefly to the question of jury instructions, and I indicated that I thought it was a related question to this sufficiency of the evidence against Wilson question. When you look at the jury charge as a whole, I would submit that there's nothing at all incorrect about the instructions that Judge Hilton gave. The Collins case, not Mr. Collins in this case, but this court's Collins case, sets forth that it's a different inquiry as to whether there's sufficient evidence that somebody's involved in a conspiracy, which does sort of take into account a possibly larger pool of drugs, and a finding of a drug weight personally distributed by a defendant and what's reasonably foreseeable to that defendant. Here, you have the instruction that I believe Judge Wilkinson was asking about, to hold the defendants accountable for the quantity of controlled substance that they personally distributed or that they could reasonably foresee that others would distribute during and in furtherance of the conspiracy. And then you have the verdict forms where Judge Hilton instructs several times, actually, when he's explaining these jury verdict forms, that the jury has to be unanimous to each count and as to each defendant, and you have separate.
Your opponent said in response to one of my questions that the use of the word they was infirm and lumped them together. What do you say with response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe I'm revealing any secrets in Department of Justice practice, but it's common when you are conforming jury instructions written for single defendant cases to multiple defendant cases, you change he or she to they. I would submit when you look at it next to the term personally, it at least with respect to this instruction, it is still clear that it requires an individualized finding. And then you put on top of that.
Your stronger point is that that separate verdict forms were submitted.
Correct. As I was saying, when you put on top of that there are these two separate jury verdict forms that have separate spaces for drug quantity, both for cocaine and cocaine base, for each defendant. So the jury was free to find three different options of drug weight for Collins for cocaine, three different options for Collins for cocaine base, and the same is true for Wilson.
And they had quantities.
Right, so it was 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, 500 grams, but less than 5 kilos or under 500 grams for cocaine, and then a similar amounts for the cocaine base, consistent with the statutory maximum, mandatory minimum triggering amounts. So what the problem that Wilson complains of is that he was sort of unfairly linked to Collins, and the jury, it wasn't clear to the jury that they could separate it out, but these verdict forms make it absolutely clear. There's no tying their drug quantity determination from one defendant to the other. It just so happens that the evidence ties them two together as partners, and the jury did reach the same findings as to each, but it is not a problem with instructions. And I would further point the court to a recent passage in a footnote in the United States versus Hassan case 742 F 3rd 104, an opinion written by Judge King and joined by Judge Wilkinson, where this footnote 18 talks about how to preserve an objection on a jury instruction. The objecting party is required to inform the court of the specific objections and grounds before the jury retires to deliberate. Failure to object will, in most instances, preclude appellate review. And here, where you're complaining about basically the difference between the word they and the word he, I would submit that that is an objection that's got to be raised so the district court can address it and so that the government can respond before the jury goes out to deliberate. As counsel for my colleague, Mr. Leibig, points out, these jury instructions were not sent back to the jury room during their deliberations, so the chances that they were engaging in this sort of hyper-technical parsing of what the meaning of the word they versus the word he is extremely unlikely. And given that the evidence in this case really was that the two were partners equally responsible for this drug distribution business and able to foresee the same amounts, I would submit that there's no prejudice on the jury instruction issue. If I could turn briefly to address the suppression issue in the case. And I think it bears just a brief mention of the facts leading up to this traffic stop that's at the heart of the issue here. You had testimony, uncontroverted testimony at the suppression hearing that the DEA in Houston and working with the Harris County Sheriff's Office gets a tip that this particular vehicle is going to show up at a residence carrying.
Unless one of the other judges want to hear it, how about go straight to the consent issue?
Sure.
Which is what's really challenged.
So the only record, only evidence in the record on consent is from two officers. I know that there's some dispute on that point, but two witnesses testified that Collins consented to the search.
Why isn't there more? Why don't we have the testimony of the officer who allegedly obtained the consent?
Well,
why isn't there more testimony on this particular aspect of the search?
There's several reasons. First, as Your Honor noted it during your examination of my colleague, Mr. Leibig, the government was not directly put on notice that the voluntariness of consent was going to be raised as an issue. And when you have this traffic stop that occurs after police and law enforcement agents observe a hand-to-hand drug deal, the government certainly, I think, was in the right to focus not only on consent, but also on the fact that there was clearly probable cause to support.
So the government didn't rely completely on consent as its sole basis?
Not at all. If you look at the government's—
Establish the legality of the search.
Judge Traxler, if you look at the government's response, it's very clear. I think we take a three alternative theory approach in our response.
Did the judge rule on anything other than consent?
He didn't. The district judge sort of stopped at consent. I think that in his mind that was the only evidence that he had, and it mooted the other issues. But this panel, I would submit, can affirm on any theory supported by the evidence in the record. And the evidence in the record here certainly is that they, having just observed a hand-to-hand drug deal,
But if we go on an alternative theory, like you're suggesting, isn't that dependent on factual findings?
Well, interesting. In this case, although Judge Hilton didn't make factual findings, there really is only one version of facts on those events in the record at all, and it is uncontroverted that these agents who testified observed Collins conduct a hand-to-hand drug deal with a female in a parking lot. He's followed right from the parking lot. They also stopped the female's car at more or less the same time, maybe there was a couple of minutes difference, and they find drugs in her car. She's got cocaine powder on her pants from trying to hide the drugs. And so I certainly would prefer a factual finding to fall back on, but with only one version of facts in the record, I would submit that the court would be free to make a finding that the search was alternatively supported by probable cause, and thus consent really wasn't the only issue here.
At a suppression hearing, does the defendant have any burden of going forward, or does the defendant merely rest by raising the issue, putting it on the government, the burden to prove voluntariness?
It's the government's burden, no question about it.
Okay.
And I don't.
Well, if it's the government's burden, then what do you have here, other than the statement, of Officer Lee, just consent, whatever that means, and the fact that the defendant was sitting at the side of the road, sitting to the side, apparently not actively protesting. What else do you have to show consent?
That's essentially what the government has in the record to show consent. However, if we're dealing with a finding by the district court that consent was valid, there is no evidence in the record that supports the notion that that was erroneous. In fact, there's no evidence in the record to support that it wasn't voluntary. Now,
you're saying you have the benefit of clear error.
Absolutely, we do, and the benefit of having a record that has nothing in it that would support a finding that this was not voluntary. Now, I understand that the defendant has no burden, but if there was really a problem with the voluntariness of consent and with Officer Lee and his bona fides, certainly the defendant could have subpoenaed Officer Lee. As I said, they did not put the government on notice that voluntariness of consent was going to be their issue, but if they knew that it was, they could have procured Officer Lee and he would have been a witness at the suppression hearing.
Would uncontradicted evidence of a drug deal, a hand-to-hand drug deal, which was personally viewed and not disputed, would that give a forward probable cause to search the entire vehicle?
Any place in the vehicle that would be large enough to conceal evidence of the drug crime. So that would be, I would submit, drugs, money.
What do you think? That's just a standard automobile search?
Correct, Your Honor.
What about the court's decisions limiting the search incident to arrest rationale with respect to automobile?
Well, this is what the government has in this case is a little bit greater than just a search incident to arrest. We actually have probable cause to believe that evidence of the drug trafficking activity would be found in the vehicle. So it's more than just someone was present in a vehicle and arrested. It is that there's independent probable cause to support the notion that there would be evidence found in the vehicle. And just like the search of a home, I would argue where there's probable cause.
The evidence of the witnessing the drug deal, did that come out at the suppression hearing?
Absolutely. That was the focus. If you read through the joint appendix with respect to the suppression hearing, that was the clear focus of the government's questioning.
That was not disputed?
Not at all.
Is it clear it was a drug deal?
I don't think it could have been any clearer, Judge Wilkinson. I'm over my time unless the court has questions on other issues. I will. Thank you.
Morning again. With respect to the questions that were posed to the government regarding sufficiency of the evidence, it was clear from the evidence that Mr. Wilson was involved in only a single deal, a 3.3-ounce cocaine deal in April. Even his participation in that deal was only last minute because of the fact that Mr. Collins was unavailable.
There was some evidence that he was involved in some other side deals, but no evidence as to dates of those side deals. Is that correct?
Correct, and not clear that it was in the course of the conspiracy because the question was posed, have you ever seen him sell cocaine or crack? With respect to
other than the one particular deal, what about his general place within the conspiracy and his close relationship with Collins and the cell phone records and the compartment where in the SUV where contraband could be concealed, and the fact that Wilson lent that to Collins as Collins needed it. So you've got one specific transaction, but you also have some evidence indicating that Wilson and Collins, that Wilson wasn't just a bit player, but he was through cell phone records and car rentals, more than a minor participant in this conspiracy. And of course, as I understand it, he's the quantity is not purely limited to a personal transaction. It's the jury can find quantity, as I understand it, from what is reasonably foreseeable on the part of Wilson that Collins would be doing. And the question is, given the reasonable foreseeability prong of the conspiracy, and given Wilson's relationship to Collins and all the other evidence that I've just been over, wouldn't there be enough for a reasonable jury to find that on the basis of the one transaction and his general relationship to Collins, that a good bit of Collins' activity was reasonably foreseeable to Wilson under classic conspiracy doctrine?
No, Your Honor. First of all, the cell phone records pertained only to the April deal. There were no cell phone records significantly. The June deal, the half-kilo deal that the government made much out of with respect to Mr. Collins, there were no phone records of Mr. Wilson's connecting him to that whatsoever. There were no phone records connecting Mr. Wilson to any of the earlier deals. The fact that these two men had a close relationship in and of itself doesn't mean that whatever Mr. Collins did was foreseeable. They may have had a close personal relationship, but the question really is what was the scope of his agreement? And I think significantly, the evidence shows that his first participation in the conspiracy is, to answer your question, Judge Keenan, the April 12th deal. That's the first evidence of a date of his participation in the agreement. And the government's indication that Mr. Wilson lent Mr. Collins the car is simply unsubstantiated anywhere in the evidence. The evidence, if you look at it, was that Mr. Wilson, according to Mr. Buckner, had driven the blue Acura on a couple of prior occasions. That's page 499 of the joint appendix. He didn't know who owned it. He knew that Mr. Wilson had driven it on a couple of prior occasions. Law enforcement saw Mr. Wilson drive that Acura one time on April 12th. So this notion...
A jury can draw inferences, and it's very unusual that we would be reversing a jury verdict for inadequate evidence given a jury's superior vantage point. Isn't it likely that if he was this intimately involved in one transaction and he had this kind of close relationship with Mr. Collins, that it was reasonably foreseeable to Wilson that Collins's drug distribution activities did not stop and suddenly magically terminate with the April 2011 transaction? Could a rational jury find that it would be highly unlikely that involvement would be limited to this one thing?
I think that would be in contravention to the evidence that Mr. Buckner very clearly testified about a wealth of drug activity involving himself and Mr. Collins, none of which involved Mr. Wilson except for this one single deal. And significantly, Mr. Buckner, who was intimately involved with Mr. Collins, didn't even have Mr. Wilson in his a list of 336 phone contacts, several of which were drug connections. Mr. Wilson wasn't in that. So to suggest that because he was intimately, because of this one involvement in a single drug transaction, that he somehow is intimately familiar with all of this other transactions that are taking place without his knowledge from the evidence, certainly without his presence, I think is really jumping too far in terms of permissible inferences that the jury could make. The other thing, the government makes much of this overpayment in the April deal. It's important to remember that there was no conversation between Mr. Buckner and Mr. Wilson during that April deal. It was simply handing drugs, handing cash. Mr. Wilson was never even made aware, according to the evidence, by Mr. Buckner that there was an overpayment. Mr. Buckner later had that conversation with Mr. Collins. He never told Mr. Wilson about an overpayment. So to suggest that that somehow is indicative of Mr. Wilson's involvement, I would suggest it actually shows the opposite. Mr. Buckner didn't even bother to consult with Mr. Wilson about the fact that it was an overpayment. Finally, with respect to...
I think you're out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate your argument. Mr. Leibig, you have some time remaining.
Thank you, Judge. Briefly, I greatly respect Mr. Benary. I need to point out some major deficiencies in the way he's argued the last point, with all due respect. The idea that the government was caught by surprise on us raising the consent issue manifestly makes no sense. You can see by the questioning, it was fully the theory upon which they proceeded, upon which they planned.
That's not what's being challenged. I mean, okay. If I'm Mr. Benary, I've asked a question, a person's testified he's consented, that's not challenged, it's not cross-examined, there's no evidence presented to the contrary. He's got a list of the things you do challenge about the search by virtue of your motion. So, you know, I can understand why when that evidence comes in without challenge about consent and the testimony is he consented, that he's not, you know, he is kind of caught by surprise when it becomes an appellate issue here.
Well, Judge, they didn't brief the, well, basically, I did object to the hearsay as to consent, and it was challenged throughout on the fact that it was allowed to be the sole basis for a finding of consent. I objected along the way to hearsay. I understand Rule 104A, but on the, having it be the very most critical fact in the whole motion to suppress, it was my point, and that was overruled.
Yes,
it was,
the question is it's certainly the government's burden to prove the voluntariness of consent, no question about that. But most of the consent transcripts that I've read, at least there's some joining of the issue, some sort of dispute about whether consent was given or not. And I'm just wondering, where is that here?
Judge, here's where it is here. A non-judge, non-lawyer stated yes to did he consent with no facts to support it. If a court says the word consent, perhaps that means voluntary consent under our case law and
well,
such. But when a layperson
represented by counsel at the consent hearing.
Oh, no, I meant the police officer stated yes to the term consent, not voluntary consent. The term consent from this man that no one knew, didn't know how long he had been a police.
Consent encompasses the word voluntary. Otherwise, it's not consent.
Well, Judge, I would respectfully disagree because Schlenkloth v. Bustamante, the Bumpers case, talks about that there's a difference between
you
mere consent.
It
could be under duress, most certainly.
Is a consent.
Judge, it quite frankly could happen easily and happens a good bit. If someone said, yes, you can search my car because you just told me you're going to arrest me anyway and I might as well let you do it now because it'll be better off for me. Yes, I consent. That's not voluntary.
Collins was represented by counsel, right?
At the motion, yes.
At the suppression hearing?
Yes.
So was there some kind of alternate version of events or some kind of dispute raised or some kind of fuss raised about the consent?
I objected to the hearsay and I didn't, since there was no discussion of voluntariness or the underlying facts, other than that, no, but the record was so devoid of evidence of voluntary consent under Bumpers, and that's why there was no evidence presented.
Did you offer an argument?
Most definitely. I argued that when it's this important that the officer wasn't here, that we didn't know what he believed consent to mean, we didn't know his training, didn't know his age. I made those arguments to the trial court, most definitely. That was the only argument that there was. When it comes to the issue of this probable cause piece, I could only ask the court to note the government didn't brief that and no drug transaction was observed. What was observed is what looked suspicious to the police. A woman gets out of her car, comes into Mr. Collins' car, sits in the car, leaves. No drugs were seen, no money were seen. Sure, we all know that's suspicious, not probable cause, and it was simply incorrect when Mr. Benary just said that a drug transaction was observed. What they believed could be a drug transaction was observed, but they didn't have probable cause. They needed to develop a traffic stop reason to stop him, which they successfully did. And importantly, while the court can decide things on other grounds, this wasn't briefed at all. Their entire brief is about consent. The courtroom argument was about consent. The objections were about consent. And the case was about consent. And the record is devoid of evidence of voluntary consent. And
okay, now, Mr. Benary has said that consent is a factual finding in the context of how this case was tried. Do you agree?
disagree. I believe that the fact that Officer Lee stated yes to the question, did he consent, is absolutely entitled to that deference. Whether that alone...
You're saying the factual finding was what the officer said, as
yes.
opposed to the legal determination of consent?
Most definitely, under all the case law, and the officer didn't even say voluntary consent, and even if he had, since he's a layperson, we have to assume he's only using the term consent like a regular person would use it, not what Bumpers requires. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Leiby, we'll do the last one. Suit you to keep going.
Sure.
Okay. All right, we'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our last case.